When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode of Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you would like to learn how to support this podcast, visit www.patreon.com/writingexcuses. Hey, listeners. We want your input on season 20, which, I have to be honest, does not sound like a real number. What elements of the craft do you want us to talk about? What episode or core concept do you use or reference or recommend the most? Or what are you just having trouble with? After 20 seasons, we've talked about a lot of things. What element of writing do you wish we'd revisit for a deeper dive on the podcast? Email your ideas to podcast@writingexcuses.com. Season 19, Episode 18. This is Writing Excuses.
How to build fictional economies.
15 minutes long, because you're in a hurry.
And we're out of money.
I'm Mary Robinette.
I'm Dong Wan.
I'm Aaron.
And I'm Howard.
And we're going to be talking about fictional economies. So three of us, myself, Aaron, and Dong Wan, recently had an opportunity to participate in something that we called the Space Economy Camp for Writers, which was designed to give writers greater literacy in economic theory for when they're doing their world building. There were a bunch of other things the camp had as a goal, but one of the things that I became aware of, even though I was one of the people helping create this camp, was that I fundamentally did not understand what the word economy meant.
I had an advantage going into this event because as an undergraduate, I had studied economics. I double majored in English literature and economics. I was a pretty poor econ student, if I'm going to be honest. You know, the statistics wasn't my strong suit. But, you know, as a literary agent, people are always like, oh, that makes sense. You studied economics and English. Those seem to marry very perfectly. But the reality is that my econ degree did nothing for me on learning how to do business. What econ isn't really about that. My understanding of economics and my interest in economics has, you know, persisted past undergraduate, is that it is very much about understanding what are the rules that make a world work, right? Economics is the study of why is the world the way it is. And so it is fundamentally really core to world building. It is not the entirety of how you do your world building, but it will play into major parts of it. What do the people in your world value? What do they need? What do they trade for? What do they not have enough of? And so I like to think a lot about What are the systems that are in place when examining a fictional world and what makes them work? What are the scarcities? What are the resources available? Why is it weird when Sam Gamgee talks about potatoes for like 10 minutes when we're not sure if the new world exists, right? You know, all these different things that can come into play of like, where are people getting sugar from to make the cakes you're writing about? Sometimes these can be really finicky, silly questions, and sometimes these can be questions that will unlock huge parts of your storytelling and give you tools to put pressure on your characters or give them things to aim for.
It's also worth paying attention to what has been described by many people, but I was introduced to it by the Freakonomics authors, as the law of unintended consequences.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
A great example of that is the moment you start paying the testing team to identify and log bugs, you will develop an underground economy between testers and coders, whereby the coders write bugs and the testers find them and give a kickback.
The economics term for that is an externality, right? And you have a negative externality or positive externality. So a nuclear power plant releases warm water as a waste product, right? It's not polluted in any sense, but it is just several degrees warmer than everything around it. So the positive externality is that manatees really love that warm water and they will congregate there and it becomes a safe place, a breeding ground, and a feeding ground for manatees. That's a positive externality. A negative externality is when that nuclear power plant melts down and then poisons the area around it for hundreds of years to come.
And radioactive kaiju manatees stomp across Florida.
In my opinion, positive externality.
Anything that involves stomping across Florida, really.
Exactly.
Manatees learning to stomp.
Yeah. But the thing that I see a lot of writers doing with the economy of their world is just thinking about, what are my coins called?
Yeah.
and not paying attention to any of the systems that are around that, or the values that the people are, you know, that are driving that. And one of the terms that came up during this camp that I was very excited about was, what is your incentive mechanism? Like, mm-hmm. why does a person do the thing that they're doing? Like, why do you show up and go to work? Why do you sit down and write? What's your incentive mechanism? What's the thing that makes you go, aha? And those can be internal. It makes you feel good. It can be external. Someone gives you money. What is the, you know, what are the incentive mechanisms in your world? Why do people do magic if magic is painful and magic and it's also secret? Like, magic mm-hmm. is going to aid you and you can't tell anyone that you're going to do it. Why do you do it? I don't know.
Yeah, it's so funny. I feel like it's sometimes we put our own, like, magic just seems so cool that you just assume in a world with magic, people would use it even if they lose a finger every time.
Yeah.
And also, no one can ever know, and all it does is warm the water 1 degree.
Yeah.
But you're like, well, that still seems like fun. It's magic. and that, you know, maybe that's, you're doing it for the reader. Like, that's the reason. But then you want to figure out, it's richer if you can figure out a reason within your world that mm-hmm. this is happening mm-hmm. as opposed to just because, like, it's fun and cool and different.
Yeah. Exactly. So think broadly about what an economy can be, right? If you're talking about gold coins or doubloons or whatever it is, you're talking about monetary, you know, like a trade economy, but they're also reputational economies, right? So the reason you might want to go save the village is because people will consider you a hero afterwards. There is an economy to that. Not everybody can be considered a hero, and getting that reputation will cost you something and will have value for the character going forward. There's also gift economies, right? There's other ways to think about how people exchange goods and services that don't have to be rooted in a capitalistic monetary system, right? So if you're imagining new worlds, if you're imagining magic systems, if you're imagining, you know, future societies, there's a lot of ways we can approach this that aren't simply rooted in our sort of extractive exchange of goods that we have now.
And I think something we don't realize is that the paths that we're used to are very well worn in our heads.
Yes.
Like, the stories that we tell about the way people are and the way people use money are, you know, we're used to them, and so they're ours. I was thinking about one of the most fascinating things we learned at this camp was about the tragedy of the commons.
Yes.
Which was a commons, and correct me if I'm wrong, is basically some sort of resource that an entire community sort of needs to take care of, like, access to water if you're mm-hmm. all fishing. And there was a theory that, okay, if that happens, somebody will exploit it. And there was an entire theory of economics that like went off on that, but there was actually no evidence of it in the real world. In truth, people don't necessarily exploit a commons, but like once it was decided, well, that's kind of what people would do because that's what a capitalist hellscape is about, then we actually developed that hellscape mm-hmm. in order to prevent the exploitation that we assumed would be happening.
Right.
Sort of you end up creating your own problems because you're used to the path that you've been on.
Yeah, this was interesting to me, too. I hadn't heard about the pushback against the tragedy of the commons because that's driven economic policy in our world for the last 50, 60 years, mm-hmm. In my own personal belief, to our detriment. You know, and right now there's a huge fight going on about the digital commons and what is a public good and what should be held back for private industry and all these different things. And it is shaping our world in really radical ways. And so it's really interesting to stop and think about, we make certain assumptions and then we build our economy based on those assumptions. So when you're building your fictional worlds, what are your assumptions about who the people are in it like, right? And what is picking a certain style of economy imply that people are like? If everything is very cutthroat and everybody has to be paid to do any kind of service or task, whether that's like mercenary work or whatever it is, then you're making very strong implications about what kind of people live there versus something like Lord of the Rings, where people are just going to get together to save the world because it benefits them, because they want to, right? There's a very different kind of economy implied by Lord of the Rings than by a Joe Abercrombie book.
Yeah.
Ask yourself what is scarce and what is necessary. There's a term, post-scarcity economy, which refers to, in essence, when everybody can have their needs met at no cost, what does the economy look like? Well, it's got the phrase post-scarcity in it, but there are some things that will necessarily still be limited or scarce, like, say, real estate. If we can all get fed, if we can all get educated, but we can't all own a piece of land, what sort of an economy develops? What happens when water is free and food is free, but we have to charge for air?
Mm-hmm.
You know, air is scarce, and we all need it.
It's one of my critiques of Star Trek, for example, right? Star Trek introduced the idea of a post-scarcity economy, but then because of the structures of producing a television show that has to be written on a certain schedule for a broad audience, the writers end up constantly reintroducing scarcity into this world and reintroducing a kind of certain kind of economics, right? Whether it's like, oh, we're going to bring the Ferengi in and suddenly money is important again, right? You know, they keep reinventing currency or they keep reinventing certain kinds of conflict because when you imagine a post-scarcity world, it requires a more radical act of thinking than a TV show is maybe not capable of, but it's hard to sustain over as long as Star Trek has existed.
One of the things that came up, so in this camp, we wound up splitting into different groups. And one of the things that came up when I was talking to an economist was there's a real world example of a post-scarcity, which was that when the empire arrived in Borneo, that the folks who were there were like, yeah, no, we have everything we need. Thanks. We're good. We're great. And they're like, but we need you to build these things. And they're like, is it interesting? If it's not interesting, I'm not going to do it. There's other things I want to do. And that was where they started to apply all of these external pressures of oppression in order to get them to do things because folks were like, yeah, there was no incentive mechanism for them to do it.
This was the opium trade too, right? Mm. To introduce a false scarcity by getting people very addicted to this thing to assert Western control over governments that were kind of like, we don't really need you. What are you doing here?
And it's so interesting. I know we have to go to the break, but I would love like in a world building way to think, what if they had actually come up instead with like some amazing incentive? Like, is it interesting? No, but we're going to make it really interesting. And here's how or why. And I think that is something that's really fun is to think about. I think a lot of times, even in my own work, you think about people bringing oppression as opposed to like bringing awe. Like maybe that's the thing that they're bringing that's lacking. The new thing, something that's going to energize people in an interesting way. And that creates in a completely different kind of world.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some more economies that you can explore in your world building.
Hey, writers, are you thinking about learning a new language? I think exploring the world, experiencing other cultures, and being able to communicate with people outside your everyday experience lets you create richer, better stories. A great way to do that is with Rosetta Stone, a trusted expert for over 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. They use an immersive technique which leads to fast language acquisition. It's an intuitive process that helps you really learn to speak, listen, and most of all, think in the language you're trying to learn. They also feature true accent speech recognition technology that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's like having a voice coach in your home. Learn at home or on the go with a desktop and mobile app that let you download and access lessons even when you're offline. And it's an amazing value. A lifetime membership gives you access to all 25 languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, German, Japanese, and, of course, Korean. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Writing Excuses listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This coming July, we have the new horror novel from bestselling author Chuck Tingle. It's called Bury Your Gaze, and it tells the story of a Hollywood TV writer who is strong-armed by studio executives to kill off the gay characters, quote-unquote, for the algorithm. When he refuses, he realizes he's put a target on his back, but what's more, monsters from his previous movies begin to haunt him and pursue him through the Hollywood Hills. It's a trenchant, clever, and gripping novel, and Chuck Tingle is back, and I couldn't be more excited.
Episode 3 of Fall of the House of Usher has a monologue in it where a character goes off on When Life Gives You Lemons, and he says, no, you don't make lemonade. You don't make lemonade. And he then takes off on this beautifully capitalistic tirade on how you turn you having nothing but lemons into a billion-dollar monopolistic global management of culture and lemons and everything. It's beautiful. And when I listen to it, when I watch it, I can't help but think, is there something besides lemons that I could also do this with? You've just given me a roadmap for developing a capitalist system that is very believable and utterly fantastic at the same time.
The thing about that is that, you know, what they did was they applied their values and the model that they understood to the problem. And it's that if, you know, if the only thing you have is a hammer, every problem becomes a nail. And again, when we're talking about the economies in our world building, the only economy that I know is the one that I grew up in, which is this capitalism thing. I had, you know, I knew that there were other things out there, but it started to get exciting for me to think about, okay, well, what happens if we're going into space and it's a gift-based economy? Mm-hmm. And what would that look like? How would people interact with that? China came up with this, came up in conversation when we were talking about gift economies, that at a certain point, you know, if you're trading with someone and you're a gift economy, it's like, oh, great, we're going to give you this. And people who are not coming from a gift economy are very confused and don't know what to do with it.
One, just to clarify a little bit by what we mean by gift economy, one thing that distinguishes a gift economy is that goods and services are given with no direct expectation of return. There's a more ambient expectation that your needs will be met down the line when that arises, maybe not by the person who directly gave you the first thing, right? Yeah. So if everyone is participating in gift society, gift economy, then needs and desires are taken care of collectively without anybody having to map out who is owed X, Y, or Z, right? Which is a very foreign concept to people who live in a deeply capitalistic sort of mindset.
The moment that I was like, oh, I understand this more, was when the economist I was speaking to said, you know, okay, but if they give you something, they've just won.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, this is the moment when you're at dinner and you're all arguing about, no, I'll get the check. I'll get the check. And that we've all experienced gift economies, especially those of us who live in the South, as politeness battles, where it's like, no, I will be the one who does the nicest thing.
Or it's just your incentive is community growth. So I always think about, I didn't know that's what it was called, but one of the things I found really interesting at the camp is I was like, well, what about barter? And one thing that I learned is that actually barter usually comes into play when you have two groups that don't either don't trust or don't know each other, mm-hmm. because they can't give each other gifts because they don't understand what to give or what the other person needs. So they figure out like one chicken equals three potatoes and three potatoes equals, you know, a trip to the moon. That's a weird economy, but.
potatoes, very valuable in that case. Yeah.
I mean, you know, they were real valuable on Mars.
That's true.
But when I, you know, my mom talking about, you know, when she used to visit rural Mississippi, where my mom's family is from, people would just be like, this person has a peach tree. And so they just give people extra peaches. Mm-hmm. These people fix fences for folks. My great grandmother would like read documents for people and sort of be like, this is something you should sign. This is something you shouldn't sign. And all of those things were just about like the community needs to look out for itself. And so it is good for everyone if we all, you know, have a good amount of peaches, have fixed fences and know, you know, not to give the government our land by mistake. And like nobody loses in that situation, but you just have to think like, what should I do for other people?
When you think about economies, really think about two things. What are you assuming that people are like? And what does your community value, right? So in a gift economy, people value community health and well-being above individual needs, mm-hmm. right? And so if you believe that actually everyone will be better off if everybody gets peaches rather than I need to extract the most value of these peaches, even if 10% of them rot, right? And those are two different sets of values. There's also two different assumptions, you know, talking about barter versus gift. You know, in a barter economy, you assume that people will try to screw each other over in a direct way. And in a gift economy, you assume that everybody fundamentally cares about other people and is going to do their best, or at least enough people are going to do their best that it'll compensate for those who are trying to be more exploitive.
We've talked about this when we talk about building a community of writers, when we talk about, you know, you going out and meeting other writers for critique groups and whatever, and how we don't want that to be transactional. There is no sense. If you come up to me at a convention and ask for a bit of writing advice, I will give it to you completely non-transactionally. Mm-hmm. I do not expect anything in return. It is possible that I won't give it to you because I'm busy or off to a meeting or brain dead or whatever, but it is not transactional. And that idea that exchanges can take place that aren't really transactions. They're not even really exchanges. It's a gift.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this idea of, I will give you writing advice. One of the things that you will hear people in science fiction and fantasy say over and over again is pay it forward. And there are these phrases that we use that underline what our values are. In Heinlein's Moon is a Harsh Mistress, you get there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. And that like gets painted on their flag, Tannstoffel.
Tannstoffel,
right. And there are these things, these phrases, these aphorisms that underline what our values are, that are an interesting piece of world building that you can do that kind of, even if you're having trouble wrapping your head around the actual economy, coming back to that can also be a grounding thing.
I also think like just looking at things that you're doing, like when you said, oh, I'll give you a piece of writing advice, the world building part of my brain is like, what if that was the thing? Like, what if that's the thing? Like, instead of the reputation economy, it's the advice economy. And when you run out of good advice to give people, you're broke. You know, what if it's gossip? Like, there's so many things that we could
I love the publishing. I do both of these.
You're like, that is my life.
Yeah.
But I think there are a lot of interesting things. So I think a lot of times we think of economies as being about always exchanging money directly, we miss all the other little exchanges that could be the basis for interesting different worlds.
Exactly.
Yeah. And there are also things like different, like our Patreon, for instance, goes back to the patron model, which used to be back in the old days. Someone's like, you know what? I just want art to exist in the world. And so you would, you know, just pay artists to do art. But part of what you were also doing at the time was you were also being like, look how fancy I am. I can look at these
artists.
Some
of this art's going on the ceiling of my house.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and it's, I'm the patron of, you know, Da Vinci. I'm the patron of Michelangelo.
Yeah.
That means that in a reputational economy, you are rich, yeah. right? You are like 1%, right? And so I think, you know, even in things that we think of as altruism, even in things that we think of as these gifts or whatever, people have reasons for doing those things. And economics is thinking about why people are making those choices on a system-wide level, right? And, you know, I love that you're connecting it to culture, right? So like Heinlein's, you know, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. Or I was thinking about Octavia Butler, right? Everything you touch, you change. Everything you change touches you. That is such a radically different view of what your values are. And that represents people trying to live according to a different kind of economic system in a world that's collapsing around them that demands something very different from them than what they are trying to accomplish, right? And that is the fundamental tension of that book, is how do you survive with these ethics and values intact?
I love that because it makes me think about that's a way to approach this, is to think about what are the values of your world?
Yeah.
And then based on that, what do they place value in? Right. How do they track that value?
I think everyone thinks that building an economy is about asking what is valuable? But instead, I think the question is, what do you value?
Yeah.
And those are two fundamentally different ideas that sound very similar.
When I leave the house, there's this checklist. I need to have my keys. I need to have my glasses. I need to have my phone. I need to have my wallet. Inquiring into each of those individually, why do I need those? Why is it unthinkable for me to be caught naked in the wilds of Orem, Utah without one of those, will inform an entire world of thought about the economy that led to them. I have to have a lock on my car and on my house, and my money is, I have to have it, and I can't see with it. Anyway, perform that same experiment on yourself. What is it that you have to have? Why?
Yeah. So I'm going to give you some homework. And this is a homework that I had, an exercise that I had my students do at at the Space Economy thing, which is to come up with three catchphrases that someone who grew up in your economy would know. So, for instance, the difference between there ain't no such thing as a free lunch versus the fictional economy that we were building for a moon, which was see it, fix it. And you can see those two totally different worlds and the economies that would spin out of those. So come up with three value statements, three aphorisms, someone that grew up in your world would say, and then see what economies spin out of those.
This has been Writing Excuses. You're out of excuses. Now go write.
Do you like stars? I do. Maybe you'd like to put up a constellation of stars by rating us on Apple Podcasts. Hello. Yes, we're talking about ratings, not astronomy. But a 5-star review can help us by creating a navigational beacon for new writers like you to find their way to Writing Excuses. So, rate us on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice.
Let's talk about the rude tales of magic. In this improvised narrative role-playing podcast, join artists, writers, and comedians from Adult Swim, Cartoon Network, Comedy Central, Marvel Comics, and more as they fight and fumble their way across the madcap and exceedingly rude fantasy wasteland of Cordelia. Branson Reese and his jester's retinue, Christopher Hastings, Carly Monardo, Tim Platt, Joe Lepore, and Ali Fisher star as a group of unlikely survivors, specifically a talking crow, a lich in a wig, a bubbly fawn, a Sasquatch punk, and a tiefling hunk. This group must solve the mystery of Polaris University's vanishment and return balance and higher education to their world. It's going to be very hard and very, very rude. Subscribe to Rude Tales of Magic on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. New episodes drop every Wednesday.
Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. For this episode, your hosts were Mary Robinette Kowal, Dong Wan Song, Aaron Roberts, and Howard Taylor. This episode was engineered by Marshall Carr Jr., mastered by Alex Jackson, and produced by Emma Reynolds. For more information, visit writingexcuses.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is a company that's pushing back against this tide. They make high-quality clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more right here in the USA. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com. Promo code STAPLE20.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.